So it was only me who dropped off there?
Yeah.
I heard nothing, to be clear. Literally, it went 3-2-1 silence.
Hello, and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. Today, we got some of our first nationwide data about the extent of the economic damage caused by the coronavirus. 3.3 million people filed for unemployment benefits last week, and that is by far the highest number of weekly claims since the government started keeping track of this data in 1967. In fact, it's almost five times the record of 695,000 people from 1982. To put that into some perspective as well, just 3 weeks ago, weekly jobless claims were historically low at just 200,000. So 200,000 to 3.3 million in 3 weeks. If you've seen the chart of these numbers, it's absolutely stunning. It's on our website. So we're going to try to put the 3.3 million number in context and ask what the future looks like, what the political effects could be, and how our politicians are trying to address the problem. So here with me to discuss are senior writer Amelia Thompson-DeVoe. Hey, Amelia.
Hey, Galen.
Also here with us is Ben Castleman, who covers economics and business at the New York Times. Longtime listeners may remember Ben, as he used to be 538's chief economic writer. Hey, Ben, welcome back.
527, is it? 545? Thanks for having me back.
Love the humor. It only took an economic collapse to get you back on with 538, but I'm glad to have you here. So, Ben, what's your initial reaction to these numbers? Is it in line with what you expected?
I mean, I think it's fairly in line with what I expected and what most economists expected, but I don't want to lose sight of just how unbelievable these numbers are. I mean, you cited those numbers at the top here. But I mean, to be talking about millions of people filing in 1 week, you know, this was the equivalent of in 1 week wiping out the past year and a half of job gains. It's going to add a couple points to the unemployment rate right here. I mean, it is just like on a scale that we have never seen before.
Yeah. Amelia, what are these numbers not quite showing yet? What's happened over the past couple weeks that isn't priced into these weekly claims?
Well, so that's the other thing that's kind of unbelievable about these numbers is there are people who have lost their jobs who are left out of this. So there are the people who lost their jobs last week and haven't actually been able to file their claim yet because there's been reports, and I've talked to several people who have been affected by this, of just crashed websites, jammed phone lines, just people unable to get through to unemployment offices, calling over and over and over again, and still can't get their claim in. So some of those people are almost certainly not captured in this data from last week. And then there are whole sort of classes of workers who are traditionally not eligible for unemployment insurance. So independent contractors are a big one, generally can't get unemployment insurance. And obviously, that's one of the groups of people where their work may have dried up considerably, and so they may really be hurting, and we just don't see that in the data. And there are some other workers, part-time workers, some part-time workers don't qualify. Tipped workers often don't, or sometimes don't qualify because they don't make enough money to meet the thresholds. So it's stunning both to look at these numbers, be kind of blown away by how huge they are, and then realize they're not even capturing everyone who's in this situation.
I mean, should we expect next week, reflecting this week's jobless claims, to be any different? Is this just the beginning?
Yeah, it is just the beginning. I mean, we could easily see these numbers again next week, and you know, we're going to continue to see, you know, big numbers for a while now. It is worth noting that some of those groups that Amelia mentioned will qualify for benefits under the package that has passed the Senate and looks like it's on the way to passing Congress very shortly. So that would extend benefits to a lot of the people who have been left out. But I mean, that doesn't change the fact that those people are not captured in these numbers.
So they could be captured in future jobless claims numbers.
Right. That's just another reason to expect that these numbers are just going to get bigger and bigger, because we'll talk more about the bill that's moving through Congress, but that's expanding eligibility and also just putting more money toward unemployment. And so that alone is going to really, you know, increase the number of people who are applying for claims, in addition to the folks who are just kind of making it through the system more slowly.
Where are overall unemployment levels headed? Ben, you mentioned that this could make unemployment rates right now tick up a couple points. What are economists saying about how bad this could get?
There's almost no question that we're going to get to 10%, which is the highest level that we saw in the last recession. But I'm hearing plenty of people suggesting that unemployment could hit 20%, could hit 30%. I mean, these are levels that we've really never seen outside of the Great Depression. And some of the numbers that, you know, we've talked for years about, you know, since the Great Recession of 2008, 2009. But, you know, we're now talking about numbers, not just on jobs, but on GDP and other things that you know, the only experience we've had in this country is the Great Depression.
This is just the start of the data that's going to be coming out. I mentioned it's the first nationwide picture we really have of the damage so far. What other numbers are you going to be looking at in order to judge the consequences of the coronavirus?
I mean, one of the challenges is that we're not going to get very much good data for a while. You know, next week we get the monthly jobs report, which you all know I'm a huge fan of. But this month is not going to capture very much of this. It's the data was collected in the second week of March, which is before the worst of this. We're going to get some numbers on retail sales that will start to show this. We're going to, you know, eventually we'll see it in things like GDP. But, you know, we're kind of flying blind here for a while in terms of the real impact of this. It's just faster than our economic data can keep up.
Amelia, oftentimes we shy away from using anecdotes in order to describe the situation on the ground, but we're relying on other sources of data, like we talked about last week, OpenTable, or the number of people in the streets, or, you know, restaurant reservations, flights, things like that. You know, you've been talking to a lot of people who have been directly impacted by this. What's the scene that you're seeing on the ground?
I'm seeing, honestly, just a lot of anxiety and confusion and fear in talking to people. And one of the things that's really struck me just in the folks that have reached out to me and that I've spoken with is the sort of the breadth of what's happening. I think that a lot of the focus for good reason has been on sectors like the service industry, restaurants, tourism that are functionally being shut down. But there are so many parts of our economy that rely on in-person interaction that we don't even think about. I was talking to a woman yesterday who's an occupational therapist, and she was saying, basically, I thought my job was recession-proof because people are always going to need the service that I provide, but I literally cannot do my job without getting, you know, I have to be within 6 inches of people all the time, like 6 feet, forget it, not going to work. And so she was laid off and she works in the healthcare industry. And so, you know, I think even within industries that overall, you know, you would think in this moment, there's a lot of demand for people. People are hurting in all kinds of ways and in ways that are sometimes very unexpected to them. So they might not be prepared financially. And then, of course, it's also hitting parts of the population that are the least prepared to weather a recession. So this is hitting low-wage workers, especially, you know, jobs that tend to be filled by women of color, single mothers, really hard. And so that's another thing that, you know, I think there's a lot of questions about how the government is going to step in and help people. But also, I've heard a lot of questions from people about whether even that help will be enough, because one of the things that's really scaring people is this question of how long is this going to go? How long am I going to need to float without an income?
Kind of an odd thing is happening today in that the stock market has been rising throughout the day despite these numbers, and we all assume it's rising because of this expected $2 trillion stimulus package that's going to be on the president's desk probably by the weekend. So, Ben, how much should we pay attention to the stock market to judge the health of the economy relative to these other data points like jobless claims?
Yeah, I mean, I would pay almost no attention to the stock market. You know, most Americans don't have stock outside of retirement accounts. It's not a good indicator of how people are doing overall. I think paying attention to the financial markets more broadly makes a certain amount of sense. Those of us who nerd out with this kind of thing pay attention to bond spreads of various kinds that can be an indicator of how well the financial system is actually functioning. And it is important for the financial system to function right now so that businesses are able to stay in business, businesses that aren't being wiped out by the virus directly. We don't want them to fail because the financial system is seizing up. But, you know, we're going to be looking for evidence in the real economy of sort of how this is actually playing out in terms of jobs and incomes. I do think it's important to note that the package, and we'll talk more, I'm sure, about the details of it, but could make a really pretty substantial impact on people's lives, right? You know, we're talking about people losing their jobs. This is an unusual situation where, you know, the goal here is not for everybody to get back to work tomorrow, right? We don't want people to go back to work tomorrow. We want people to stay home, but we want to make sure that when they stay home, they're able to continue to put food on the table and they're able to hold on to their homes. And we want businesses to be able to stay in business enough that they can open back up once we get through this. And so the question isn't sort of a traditional stimulus where, you know, how do we get people to go out and spend? The question is, how do we make sure that people are still alive and you know, financially relatively healthy once they can go back out and spend? And that's a very different set of questions.
Last week, Amelia and I spoke with economist Tara Sinclair, and we asked whether there was any question about whether we were in a recession. And she said that it's hard to describe what exactly is happening because it's never happened before. You know, the standard definition, of course, of a recession is when GDP falls for two consecutive quarters. Now, we're just at the very beginning of this, but is a recession kind of the only possibility at this point?
I don't think there's any question that we are going to have something that meets the technical definition of a recession. But I am not sure that a recession is the best framework for thinking about this from a policy perspective or from understanding the economy, right? This is not a case where some part of the economy got out of control and, you know, we kind of needed it to reset itself in some way. You know, we didn't have a housing bubble or a dot-com bubble or anything like that. And it's not a situation, again, where we need people to rush out and spend to try to get the economy going again. Somebody described it to me yesterday as that we need to put the economy in a medically induced coma. You know, we need to yeah. pause things for a period so that then it can pick back up quickly and hopefully be, you know, in the best shape possible once we come back. That's a very different circumstance from kind of what we traditionally think of in a recession.
Yeah, Amelia, you were asking the question about how long could this last and people being worried about how long they're going to have to make provisions for being out of work. I think there is a lot of variance in terms of the projections that epidemiologists, health experts put out. Ben, from the economic perspective, obviously people who work on Wall Street, people who are crunching these numbers are making their own projections about how long they think this is going to last. What does that picture look like from an economist's perspective?
I mean, there are a lot of economists who are playing epidemiologist right now. My general advice would be to ignore all of their attempts to do so. There are epidemiologists for a reason. Economists love to think they can, you know, make every kind of model better than anybody else, but it's not true. They're better at economics models and not much else. You know, I think that the how long can it last question from an economic standpoint depends so heavily on the policy response. Let's envision a scenario here, right, where we beef up the unemployment system and, you know, take other steps in such a way that everybody who's out of work right now gets their normal income coming in. In that scenario, you could continue, people could continue to pay their rent, they could continue to put food on the table, they could continue to meet their financial obligations. It's going to cost the government a lot of money. And we can talk about what the implications of that are. But you could imagine we could come out the other side of this and, you know, people could go back and resume their jobs and resume their daily lives. If they don't get that, then we know that a very large percentage of people have very little financial cushion and they're going to get into trouble very, very quickly.
And so you're talking about kind of how unemployment spirals into lots of bankruptcies, defaults on houses, like things, that's what spirals when you get high levels of unemployment?
Yeah, once people, so, I mean, imagine all these people in, who work in restaurants and work in directly affected sectors, they all lose their jobs. If they don't have an income and they don't get enough help to support them, then they're not going to be able to spend money. And now all of a sudden, all of those sectors that are relatively insulated from this, they're not insulated anymore, right? You can't keep your Netflix subscription because you don't have a job anymore. You can't keep, you know, buying food because you don't have a job anymore. And then that spirals through the economy. And then you can imagine, right, even when we come out of this, of the health crisis portion of this, all those businesses that have failed, all those people who have lost homes, the banks that have failed as a result, you know, all of that becomes so much harder to restart. And then you get a recovery that looks much more grinding and much more difficult.
Right. Well, and the other thing I'd add is that all of this is connected. The policy response is connected to the health crisis, is connected to our ability to rebound economically. And it's really hard to untangle any of those things right now, because our ability to contain the virus is also going to have an effect on the economic response. A couple of economists have mentioned to me, you know, sort of, we need eventually the economy to restart down the road. We'll need people to go out and want to spend and want to fly on airplanes again and want to do all the things that we were doing. And if people don't feel that they can do that safely, if we don't feel that the virus has been contained and there's still worries about sort of going outside and doing all these things, you know, the longer that that goes on, the harder it will be for our economy to return to normal. And so I think there's a sense in which, yes, the economic situation right now looks pretty dire, but as long as we can keep people afloat and try to sort of freeze our economy in amber, or, you know, whatever metaphor you want to use for when the public health crisis has diminished to a point where we're ready to say to people, yes, okay, it's safe for you to go back to your job, then those are the investments we need to be making and the trade-offs we need to be making. And it's a pretty painful trade-off. But as you were saying, Ben, it's one that we can use policy to address and make sure that people sort of have the resources they need to weather this.
Yeah. And Amelia, just to add on that, I mean, something that Jerome Powell, the Fed chairman, has said, he said it this morning on television, he said it repeatedly, is, you know, this is first and foremost a health crisis, right? This is not 2007, 8, 9 was an economic and financial crisis, and we had to fight it like that. This is a health crisis first, and there's nothing that we can do to solve the economic crisis until we can address the health crisis.
Yeah, President Trump has expressed impatience over the economic consequences of our response to coronavirus, which I'm sure listeners have heard. He said he wants to get things back up and running by Easter, which is April 12th. As you've mentioned, health experts such as Dr. Anthony Fauci and economists such as Jerome Powell say that that's like not really how things work. The process could take much longer, and that the health consequences need to be dealt with first. Have either of you encountered economists who say, no, this is just not worth the consequences, and people need to get back out and we need to open things up almost regardless? Is there anybody in the economist community who is on the same page as the president in terms of that kind of timeline?
I'd be curious to hear what you've heard, Ben. I have talked to some folks who feel, I don't think anyone is saying, let's go completely reopen the economy, go back to normal on April 12th. I have talked to some people who have said, you know, the idea that these shutdowns would continue sort of indefinitely, that's worrying to them, and they want this to continue in a sort of more targeted way. I think the issue is, and what I've heard from other economists, is that, you know, maybe we could have had a more targeted approach if we had planned better for this, if we had the testing and surveillance infrastructure that we needed to do what South Korea did, for example. But we're not at that point. And so, you know, we missed the boat. Basically, we missed our window. We can't go back in time and fix that. And so now, you know, yes, you can say in theory, we could have a more targeted approach. We could have, you know, certain people going back to work maybe, but that we're just not at a point where that's realistic anymore. I'm curious what you've heard from folks though, Ben.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty consistent with what I've heard. There are certainly some economists who argue that, you know, this shutdown is sort of going too far, or it will go too far if it lasts for very long. Most of those economists are frankly people who have worked in this White House or still work in this White House. I think the challenge here is back to the issue of the epidemiology of this. If we send people back to work before we have cracked the health problem, then we're just going to reinfect a whole bunch of people and we're going to be right back where we are now, except minus the confidence of the public that anybody knows what they're doing. So, I mean, this idea that it is either a health crisis or an economic crisis and we have to sort of balance the two, I think sort of misses the real point here, which is that this is a health crisis no matter what. It's an economic crisis no matter what. And we have to solve the two of them together. You can't sort of pick one.
The other thing that I'd just add to that is, you know, I think the response that I've heard from the president and from other people who are sort of seem eager to reopen the economy seems to assume that the economic damage is the result of the response and not the pandemic. And the economy was already, you know, like people were already not flying on airplanes before states started shutting things down. You know, if we start reopening in a piecemeal way, that doesn't, you know, people are still going to stay home. State governors are still going to keep their states shut down. So this idea that you can sort of, as Ben was saying, somehow separate the economic response from the health reality right now, I think is just not true.
I want to move on and talk a little bit about the stimulus package, or, you know, there's some debate over whether to call it a stimulus package even, but just a final point on this. Emilia, you've been talking to a lot of people who've been affected by the coronavirus from an economic standpoint. What's their view? I mean, are they kind of frustrated and want the economy to open back up? Or is there a general understanding that this is just how things need to work for now?
I have not talked to a single worker who wants to go back to work right now. I have talked to a lot of people who are feeling extremely financially insecure and are really worried about how they're going to pay their rent. And I haven't talked to anyone who has said, you know, I think I should be allowed to go back to my job. I think there's much more of a sense that, you know, this is what we have to do right now. And I might be worried about my personal financial situation and I might be looking for help from the government. But at least among the people that I've talked to, there's a pretty broad sense that this is the right thing to do.
I will say, I mean, I've talked to, as well, to a number of people. Most of them, I think, have fallen to that same category. But I have talked to a couple of people who have lost their jobs and think this is all a total overreaction, that they would love to go back to work tomorrow. You know, I think we've heard a certain amount of the skepticism in particularly the conservative media over the severity of this. And that is certainly reaching some workers. So I think that is a view that exists out there.
But I think I've actually been surprised. I was expecting to encounter a lot more of that. And, you know, certainly this is what happens when you just talk to a handful of people. You know, you don't get the most representative sample. But I don't know. I mean, Ben, have you been surprised by how broadly were you expecting that view to kind of take root? Because I have personally been surprised by how few people have seemed sort of disgruntled about the fact that, you know, they've lost their job because of this. And they've certainly been unhappy about a lot of the circumstances surrounding it, but not necessarily blaming the shutdown.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. I mean, the first wave of layoffs here has really hit, sort of by definition, the workers who were most in contact with people, right? Whether that's, you know, servers or retail workers or people in travel, like all sorts of different jobs in which people encounter a lot of people. And so I think it's not all that surprising that those people were particularly concerned about the idea of going to work and being exposed to strangers all day. It's just relatively easy if you've got a white collar job and you're working from home right now to say, oh, this is all stupid and overblown. If you're facing, you know, going up and being 6 inches away from dozens or hundreds of strangers over the course of the day, you might think about this a little bit differently.
All right. So we'll see how this all progresses as it reaches other parts of the economy as well. But let's turn to that $2 trillion package that was passed late last night, Wednesday night, in the Senate. How does it go about trying to stem the economic damage? And is it likely to be effective from what we can tell at this point?
Yeah, so I mean, this package does a lot of things. It's $2 trillion, obviously, and I don't think we probably want to go through each of those dollars individually. But I'll highlight a few things that it does. You know, people have paid a lot of attention to these direct payments to people, $1,200 per adult, $500 per child for sort of most families. You know, that's a pretty meaningful stimulus. It's larger than anything we saw in the Great Recession. That's going to put a lot of money in people's pockets. It's a one-time payment. And I hear a lot of people sort of saying, you know, that's not going to do me that much good if I've got, you know, rent coming due every month. But that's probably pretty helpful for getting people through rent or a mortgage payment this month, or at least once that check actually comes through. It's going to be a couple of weeks anyway. The unemployment piece of this, I actually think, is probably the single most significant thing. Two really big things there. They're broadening as we discussed earlier, it's broadening significantly who's eligible. So it extends to a lot of gig workers, a lot of independent contractors, a lot of part-time workers, people who may not have been covered in the past. And then it's adding $600 a week onto every single one of those checks. So if you think about it, if you earn $1,000 a week, right around $50,000 a year, you are probably getting, would normally get kind of $300, $400, depending on where you live, in an unemployment check. This is now going to take you up to $900 or $1,000. It's going to replace most of what you were missing out on. So, you know, to our earlier point about, you know, how do we sort of, I liked Amelia's analogy, to freeze the economy in amber so that we can bring it back. You know, that actually conceivably could do a pretty important, being a pretty important step in that direction. And then, of course, there's a lot of money here that's going to helping businesses in various ways. That's going to be controversial. The B word, bailout, is going to get thrown around a lot. And we can certainly talk about that some more. But I think one thing that is worth highlighting there is there's a very good reason to want to ensure that most businesses are able to, in some form, stay in business through this. You know, we don't want to, whenever this ends in 2 months or 3 months or 6 months or whenever it is, we don't want to need to sort of start the entire economy over again, to have new restaurants start up to replace the old ones, right? As much as possible, we would like basically healthy businesses to survive this. And so that's one of the things that the bill is going to try to do.
Right. And on that note, one of the things in the bill also is sort of trying to incentivize businesses to actually keep people on their payrolls, because that's one thing that I have heard a lot of concern about, is that people are just being laid off. And I've talked to some business owners who have said, you know, I laid off my whole staff because I thought it was the most ethical thing to do, because then they can go easily apply for unemployment insurance. And I thought that was the best way to help them. But that means that even if that employer has the intention of rehiring all of those people whenever it is that they're able to reopen, severing that relationship just adds a layer of difficulty in getting those workers back on the job and working again. And you can imagine that, you know, inevitably they're not going to be able to rehire all of them, especially in these industries that have really high turnover, like the service industry. And so that's part of it too, trying to, you know, sort of help businesses bear the financial cost of keeping people on the payroll. There's also a rescue component for hospitals, which is something that is really important and the whole medical system seems to be really in need of, for obvious reasons right now. There's also a piece of this that I think invests in more telemedicine, which is going to be important for the parts of the healthcare system that can sort of transition to more of a telemedicine focus. And that'll help ensure that hopefully that people are able to continue to get some healthcare services while they're sort of in their home. So I think those are two important pieces as well.
Should we expect further government intervention here, or is this designed to get us through the bulk of what we're facing.
Most economists I talk to say this is a down payment. It's an important down payment. I mean, I think it's really significant that Congress has moved quickly to, I mean, this is a really big number that they've put together pretty quickly. But I think most economists would say that there's still going to need to be more there. If this goes on, then you could certainly imagine needing more checks. I would say that the one real piece of this that really seems still to be missing in talking to people is the state and local government piece of this. That, you know, state and local governments are getting hit from both directions right now. They're seeing a total collapse in tax revenue, right? If you think about sales tax, income taxes, right, all of that's going to take a huge hit. And then they have enormous expenses. I mean, if you think about what's happening in Seattle and Washington State right now, or what's happening in New York, there are just huge expenses, and there's been very little done so far to help those states. Those state governments are going to be in real trouble. And, you know, state governments, unlike the federal government, generally have to balance their budgets, which means that if they end up in a deficit situation, they either have to raise taxes or they have to cut programs, which is exactly what you don't want them to do right now. So that seems to be the big hole in this bill that's probably going to have to get filled in at some point.
Yeah, looking at this from a global standpoint, countries across the world right now are taking similar measures with unprecedented price tags, right? This is more than double the stimulus package from 2009 from America's perspective. Are there downsides to a whole bunch of countries around the globe taking on unprecedented amount of debts all at one time?
You know, there's definitely going to be a point at which there is some sort of reckoning here on the government spending side. But I think, you know, we're quite clearly not there right now. I mean, certainly from the U.S. perspective, the government can borrow money right now practically for free. And so, you know, what the markets are saying is spend, 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 borrow, 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 do what you have to do. That's a more complicated story in, you know, many other parts of the world, certainly including, you know, parts of Europe that were already in a more challenging fiscal situation. But, you know, to our earlier point about this being a healthcare crisis, you know, none of this makes any difference if we don't get the healthcare crisis under control. And so, you know, I think what we're seeing from governments around the world is you have to spend the money now and we'll figure out how to deal with the consequences of that later.
Amelia, to wrap things up here, what has the political process of all of this been like? You know, from the perspective of people who have been following Washington and politicians on this podcast for over 4 years now, this seems to have happened remarkably quickly. What had to happen in order to get there?
Yeah, I mean, it has been quite fast. That does not mean that there was no fighting. There was quite a lot of fighting in Congress to get to this point. And the sort of initial proposed solution that Senate Republicans brought out just about a week ago looked quite different and had a much lower price tag than what we are seeing right now. You know, I think this is a situation where necessity forced people to move more quickly than I think their political goals would have indicated at other moments. Already there are concerns about whether this money is going to get to people fast enough, you know, and get to small businesses fast enough. And I think there's just a sense that it was going to be catastrophic if the government did not move quickly. And so even though there were disagreements, and I think, you know, there are definitely people on both sides of the aisle who are deeply unhappy with parts of this package, there seemed to be a recognition among folks in Congress that they had to get something together and they needed to do it really quickly.
All right, well, let's leave things there. Thank you so much, Ben, for joining us today. A bit of a throwback Thursday. Hope you enjoyed being back on with 538, if only for a brief moment.
I look forward to joining you to discuss the stunning and successful recovery.
It is a date, Ben.
And Amelia, thank you as well.
Thanks, Galen.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. You can also subscribe to us on YouTube. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.